Hi, and welcome to the Well Read Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion on books and reading. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Anne.
And we are librarians with the Beaufort County Library in South Carolina. This week, we're going to be talking about books featuring ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. And I don't really know how we thought of this topic. Do you know how we thought of this topic?
We have... So one of the things that we use is Google Docs. It's great. And we have a running list of ideas and suddenly it appeared.
I think I put it on there.
Yeah, I can't see me putting this.
I think I put this on there. And I don't really know why I thought of it. But I think that I must have thought of a particular book that fit this theme. Yeah. And then thought, well, that would be an interesting theme because I think we're all ordinary people. And it's always interesting to read about people who come from kind of an ordinary background and do interesting and exciting things with their lives. So I think that's kind of where I got it.
Yeah.
And when I put it down, I did it with the intention of focusing more on nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But then as I was coming up with ideas, I thought, well, there are a lot of fiction books that I can think of that fit this theme too. So I actually have two nonfiction and one fiction.
I think I'm the
same.
And
I think you do too.
Yeah.
I think we could probably just go ahead and get started, don't you? It's kind of a self-explanatory topic.
Yeah, we don't have a why this is a appeal. I guess we could talk about the appeal of it, but I think you just said fun to see. And I think it's neat to see that people can be valued even if they're not rich and famous, and that you have this everyman making a difference in the world idea. And I think that a lot of people find a lot of comfort in that and like to see people like themselves that are making a difference for other people. So
I think you just summed that up very well.
That's so nice.
So tell me what your first one is.
So my first book is called Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. And full disclosure, Hallie and I fought over
this
but I won because I'm better at arm wrestling. So that is not true, but I did tell Hallie about this book. So
she got priority because she told me about it.
So this is one of my favorite books of the last year. It came out in 2014, and Brian Stevenson is a lawyer and a professor. I can't remember what university he works for, but he lives in Alabama and does his social work in Alabama, but then teaches in New York. So he's got a very, very full life. He runs the Equal Justice Initiative, which is a nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to prisoners who are possibly wrongly accused or have been denied a fair trial and generally can't afford representation, and that the public defense system has not worked for them. So the main thread of the book covers the case of Walter McMillian, who was a man that was put on death row. And I believe he was on death row before he was even convicted.
Yes, which is flabbergasting.
Yeah, there's so many things in this book that you think, oh my gosh, how does it even work this way? This is not the way that I've been taught the justice system works.
And so I kept thinking I could see it if it was from like the early 1900s or 1950s or something, but this was recent.
Right.
This was happening recently.
Right. Yeah. There's so many things to blow your mind in this book. So he was put on death row for a murder that he insisted he didn't commit. And he had a dozen witnesses who place him elsewhere when this crime was committed. But he was still convicted based on the problematic testimony of only one person. So that's the main case that Brian Stevenson is working on. But then he sort of uses every other chapter to talk about other issues in the justice system that he's frustrated with. So there's specific issues like the drastic increase in incarceration over the past 30 years, children being tried as adults, and the horrible things that happen to them when they're in prison in that system. And it can be really a hard book to read at times, but overall there's this argument for mercy. And he's obviously very anti the capital punishment and wants to do away with the death penalty. So this can be a little bit of a polarizing book if that's something you feel strongly about. But I think that he gives a really strong argument, and it's a really powerful argument that people that seem irredeemable can be redeemed. I think that he's particularly extraordinary because he's devoted his entire life to this. As far as I can tell, he doesn't do anything else besides this. Even in his book, he doesn't talk about his family. He doesn't talk about a personal life.
He doesn't have much of a personal life. I think he mentions that in the book.
Yeah, that he's had to sort of do away with things and like says, I took a brief moment to play basketball with one of the other lawyers. And I just think that this is what he does. Sleeps at his office, that kind of thing. He really tries to advocate for people that society has written off. And I first heard of him, I was at PLA, which is a Public Library Association conference last year. And I thought he was the keynote speaker. And I thought this is just going to be some bland motivational speech about whatever, lame things that people talk about. But I ended up taking tons of notes and I maybe cried. And he just had all kinds of stories that were that just blew me away. And a lot of them are covered in this book. So the feeling I have about him is that he's just legitimately one of the best people I've ever heard of. He's just amazing. And he's just a regular person. He's a lawyer that comes from a poor family and was able to get a good education, but he doesn't have like big wigs backing him, right, and have all this funding. So I think that his stories are a really powerful reminder that we don't know everything about the circumstances of someone's lives, and that even if we did something wrong, we still deserve to be treated humanely. And one of the closing thing that I think is really important about him is that he says that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. And that's just kind of a revolutionary idea right now, I think.
Chills.
So I know.
Literally.
Oh, I love Bryan Stevenson so much. So that's Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. And this is a book, I know that you have books where you just tell everyone to read them. And this is one for me.
Yes. And I'm sitting here thinking, if our listeners are going to read one book that we have talked about, this is our 12th episode in any of our episodes, mm-hmm, this would be the book I would say to read.
Oh, definitely.
Regardless of your feelings about capital punishment, it's worth reading this just for the stories of how people are treated, mm-hmm, in prison, particularly the children, mm-hmm, and people with mental illness. I think it's eye-opening, and mm-hmm, I just really think that it's worth reading. No matter.
Well, and he even has stories about people like guards that have changed their lives. Right. And there's just so many amazing things about this book. I give it as gifts all the time, mm-hmm, and I've never had a bad report back on it. So.
All right. So my first one is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. This is sort of stretching the definition of our topic, but it's such a good book that I just had to talk about it. It is about a woman named Henrietta Lacks, who was a 31-year-old Black mother of five when she died of cervical cancer in 1951. And at the time, she was being treated at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and they removed some of her tissue for research, which is very common practice. They did not ask for her permission, and she didn't know that they were taking some of her tissue for research. Like I said, they did this a lot. From what I understand, they still do this a lot.
If you go
to a hospital, there's a strong likelihood that your blood or cells are being used for other purposes. So the issue is that her cells were harvested and were the first cells ever that kept reproducing, and to this day are still reproducing. So 65 years later, almost. And have been instrumental in many medical advancements, such as the cure for polio and AIDS treatments and in vitro fertilization and gene mapping. I mean, all of these medical things that have happened since 1951 can be traced back to the cells that they harvested from her that are still reproducing. And they're considered immortal because they just keep reproducing, hence the title. And Johns Hopkins sold these cells. So they were making money. And then now I'm forgetting the details a little bit, but I feel like now it's not Johns Hopkins anymore, but somebody else sells these vials of cells, or however they're portioned out. And meanwhile, the Lacks family was never compensated in any way for the use of the cells, and didn't know until Rebecca Skloot started researching this topic that they even existed. The only reason she knew about it was because she was in a biology class where a professor was talking about these cells, which are called HeLa cells, and he referred to the person by name, which at the time he said Helen Lane, mm-hmm, was the person's name that they came from. But then she ended up in multiple other biology classes in college, and HeLa cells were constantly referred to, but the person behind them was never talked about. And so she started researching to find out what the story was behind these cells and who this person was. And so she's the one who started interviewing the family and finding out what their situation was. And they're not a wealthy family, mm-hmm, and they haven't had a lot of breaks in life. And so there's a real sense from the people that she interviewed that there's an anger there, that people have profited from something that they feel like their mother or their family member was misused, mm-hmm, in a way, and because she didn't give permission for this to be done, and all of these things have happened from these cells that they haven't had any benefit from, but many other people have, mm-hmm, and questions about how she was treated as a poor Black woman in the 50s and what her treatments were. And so Rebecca Skloot does a really good job of it's very non-judgmental the way she presents the information. So she's not coming down on one side or another about the scientific advancements being worth doing this or what the Lax family should have been compensated for. Like, she just lays out all of the facts. She got to know the people in the family, particularly Henrietta's daughter, very well in the 10 years that she was researching this book. But there's definitely a sympathy in her tone to the family. I don't really consider myself a nonfiction reader. Mainly when I pick up a nonfiction book, it's because my book club is doing it, yeah. Or it's a memoir. I've talked before, I love celebrity memoirs. So that's the kind of nonfiction I read. I'm a very light, fluffy nonfiction reader. But this one really captured my attention, and it never got bogged down in the science. That's sort of what I had heard about this book for a while before I finally read it. And I was really worried that the scientific portion of it was just going to make my eyes glaze over, right, and I wasn't going to be able to follow it. But she really does a great job of presenting it in a way that the layman can understand and really find it fascinating and not feel like it's above their knowledge, you know, base. And I think everybody can identify with the concept of you're in a very vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. You're being treated for something that eventually might kill you. And in Henrietta Lacks' case, did kill her. And so you're at the mercy of these doctors and the people in the hospital. You're trusting them to do right by you. And then she ended up dying, but then they are profiting from what they did. So it's just a really fascinating look at something that really changed medical history and the people behind it. And it's not just the science. So that's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot.
I'd heard an interview with Rebecca Skloot where she talked about how hard it was to get the family to trust her because they were so distrustful of the whole, how they'd been treated and how they just didn't think anything good could come from this and that it was a really huge hurdle to overcome.
And it wasn't a one-time thing where then once they trusted her, that was it. Right. She was on their side and they were fine with it. It was a constant issue that she had with them, that there was a conversation that was happening, and she'd think she would make some headway, and then suddenly she'd realize she hadn't. So that whole part of the story is fascinating too. Some of the things that happened to the family since Henrietta's death are sad, and so she has a lot of empathy for the people in the family. So as we're recording this, Banned Books Week has just finished. It's not going to post for a little while. And somebody challenged this book recently.
Really?
I don't know if you saw that.
It
was on a high school reading list, and a mother decided that it was, she said, pornographic, because there's a scene in the book where Henrietta Lacks gets in the bathtub and feels her cervix for a bump on her cervix. And that's when she realizes that she has cervical cancer. And so it's brought up a lot of discussion about challenging books and banning books and what people expect. And it was great because the high school really stood behind it and were like, no, this is not pornographic.
Right.
This is a gynecological conversation. This has nothing to do with pornography.
Right.
So it's kind of appropriate.
Yeah. I need to read that one. I've had so many people recommend it to me and I just have never gotten to it, but I think it's a very important story to hear about. So my next book is Life and Death in Shanghai by Nian Cheng, and this is a memoir. Nian Cheng was educated in London and employed by Shell Oil, and she was the widow of an official who served in Chiang Kai-shek's political regime, and maybe you listeners know more about Chinese history than I do, so I had to look up some stuff. Chiang Kai-shek was the president of China who fought a civil war against the Chinese Communist Party and then lost the war and fled to Taiwan. So that's sort of the separatist group that tried to rule China in an exiled government and was not successful in that. So because she had ties to this, what was seen by the Chinese government at the time, this rebel government, she had ties to the West. She was employed by a Western company. Then she was a prime target for being questioned by during the Cultural Revolution. And so Red Guards ransack her home and take her in for questioning and ultimately accuse her of being a British spy. And she refused to admit that her lifestyle and her history made her an enemy of the state and that she was a good Chinese subject. But she was taken to prison and held in solitary confinement for 6 years. So,
oh my gosh.
During this time, she endures beatings. She is malnourished. She lives in squalid conditions. She has these interrogations that are really horrific, and she is confronted by former friends who say false things against her, specifically that she was a British spy, and she has no idea of what's happening to her family outside of prison. She has a daughter that I think she just has the one daughter, and then her husband has died, but she has no idea of anything else that's going on. But ultimately, this is a memoir of survival and moving on after you've lost everything. So because she wrote the book, we know that she survives mm-hmm. this ordeal. And I think it's a remarkable book because I don't know that much about Chinese history, but from what I understand that it's almost unheard of to get a firsthand account of resistance mm-hmm. in communist China. And since she was able to leave, she's able, she ultimately ends up in Washington, D.C., and she's able to write this book. And I think that her life is extraordinary because she's just so resilient, and there are so many moments where she could have told a lie and that her life would have been a lot easier. And I'm sure she still would have been punished for the things that she was admitting to, but it would have probably benefited her in some way to say these things. But she has this complete dedication to the truth, even at a great cost to herself. So it's been many years since I've read this book, but it's really stuck with mm-hmm. me as just a really amazing memoir. Mm-hmm. So that's Life and Death in Shanghai by Nian Cheng.
That sounds so good. I don't know that I've ever read anything about communist China.
Yeah. Mm. No, I definitely not a memoir
right.
of it.
Yes.
So, wow. Yeah, it's a good book.
My next one is Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal by Connor Grennan. And this is also a memoir. It's set in 2006. Connor Grennan was in his late 20s. And he had been working for a little while, and he decided to take a year off of work and to travel around the world. And he felt a little bit superficial when he would tell people that he was going to do that, because it just seemed like for a year he was just going to go off and have fun and travel and not contribute to the world. Uh-huh. So he decided to start his first 3 months volunteering at an orphanage in Kathmandu, Nepal. And he went there and was very affected by the children that were in the orphanage. And he did continue on for his year-long trip, but he ended up, after the year-long vacation, basically, mm-hmm. or travel, he ended up back at the orphanage, because what he found out was that most of the children in the orphanage weren't actually orphans. They had been living with their families elsewhere in Nepal, often in the mountains, and child traffickers had lied to the families and told them that for a fee, typically a large fee, that they would keep the children safe and out of harm's way because there was civil war going on in the country. But in actuality, they would just take the children away from the families and then abandon them somewhere remote. And so they didn't have a chance to get back to their families.
Oh my gosh.
So when Connor realized that, it became his life's mission to try to reunite the kids with the families and to make just a better life for the kids in general. And it came at a physical cost for Connor, because he literally would be the one trying to trek through the mountains to find these families and these villages and these places. So it wasn't like he was just sitting back somewhere in an office making phone calls or something.
Right.
He was really putting himself out there to try to track down these families and reunite them with the children. And he also started a nonprofit organization in America to raise money to provide for these children and to provide the resources so that they could go out and try to find the families. And it was just really an inspiring story about exactly what we're talking about. This is just some ordinary guy who was mm-hmm. in his 20s, who was wanting to take a trip around the world and a little break from work, and really found his life's passion mm-hmm. and this mission to help all these children. And the story is about, I actually listened to this as an audiobook, and it's Connor Grennan himself who narrates it.
Oh,
and it
cool.
was so great, because he would tell the stories of these little kids talking to him, and he would do their little accent of, you know, and so you could just picture these little kids. And of course they loved him because he was living near them, and his stories of living in Kathmandu were very interesting. It's such a different experience from what he had lived mm-hmm. in the United States. So that's Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal by Connor Grennan.
Do you remember how he finds out that they're not orphans? Does he?
Oh, that's such a good question. I don't. It's been a little while.
I have to read the
book. 4 years since I read the book. But I don't remember. I don't know if it's one of the children that says something to him that makes him realize it. I just don't mm-hmm. remember. But then once he discovers that, he realizes. And I should say, not all of the orphans are do have families, but right. that's something he has to work through and figure out.
Oh, that's if they so have interesting.
So it was, yeah, it was
there's so really, many layers of like discovery right, in right. there that are, yeah. that's really interesting.
So I would highly recommend it. This was one, like you said about Just Mercy. This is one when I read it that I recommended to so many mm-hmm. people because it was a book that I hadn't heard of. And then it came across my radar and I just felt like this was, like I said, very inspirational about what one person can do
yeah.
And change people's lives.
Yeah. That sounds great. Okay, so my next book is Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine. And this is considered YA, but it's not really a light book. So I think it's a really good pick for adults if you haven't delved into YA at all. It's a World War II story of two British girls who are involved in the war effort. And a big part of this book is the narrative structure. And I'm going to really try to not give too much information away because so much of it is based on the structure of the book. But it starts with you're reading a written confession from a British spy named Verity, and she's been captured by the Gestapo, and she was captured because the plane that she was in was being flown by a female pilot named Maddie, and it crashed. Verity and Maddie, you find out through the beginning of the book, are best friends, and they grew up together, I think in Northern England or Scotland maybe. But after the crash, then Verity leaves Maddie behind, and we don't know why in this wreckage. So now Verity is being forced to supply Germans with details of Maddie's British Air Force mission, and she either does that or she's going to be killed. And she sort of knows she's going to be killed no matter what, but they're torturing her as well. So there's a lot of details of her life in this terrible scenario. But the confession really becomes a record of their friendship together, and it covers a lot of Verity's regrets. It has some kind of funny ways that she tries to be subversive to the Nazis that are holding her, and it's her personal struggle to stay courageous in the face of evil when she feels like she's a failure because she left her friend. That's really all the details I'll tell about the book because there's so much more to it. That's all pretty early on in the story. But it really is my favorite part of this book is the portrayal of female friendship and that these two girls, like, I guess they're probably women at this point, have this sisterly bond. And we read a lot of books about female friends, but a lot of them have sort of this cattiness to mm-hmm. them that they have to overcome. And that's not at all part of this book. It's just a really great book. I think that the extraordinary lives aspect comes into it when you start to think about the things that regular people did in World War II, that they did such brave things and we obviously revere them, but I don't know that any of us really understand how many common people did these extraordinary things. And I feel like when I read, I've read other maybe blog posts or other people talk about this, that you can get a little bit impatient with World War II books because there are so many people that are writing essentially the same story and not a lot of people are bringing a lot of perspective or new perspective into it. And that does a disservice to how amazing these people were. And so it's kind of sad that this has become regurgitated so much that we're losing focus of how incredible people lived at that time and how much they sacrificed. So I was really glad for this book that sort of reminded me of that and made me think about common people and how they had to overcome they had to face the greatest evil mm-hmm. in the world to mm-hmm. in order to overcome it. So it's a great book and I hope everyone reads it. It's called Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine.
Yes, I liked this book a lot and I think that you did a good job of giving information without giving away too much because I definitely think this book is best when if you go in without knowing too much about it.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot that's told at the beginning, but then there's a lot more to be told later on. And what's your last book?
My last book is The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd. And this is also fiction, but it is based on real people and real events, which is one of my favorite kinds of
yes.
fiction. It is about Sarah Grimke, who is the daughter of a wealthy plantation owner in Charleston in the early 19th century. And she is a real person mm-hmm. that existed. She was raised to be a conventional wife, mother, and slave owner. You know, the expectation was that she would marry somebody and live on a plantation and be that typical Southern woman in that pre-Civil War time. But she really longs to do something different with her life. She has a dream of being a lawyer. Her father is a lawyer, and I think her brother is a lawyer as well. And so she has this idea in her head that she could do it until one day at dinner she comments about that being her aspiration and is just laughed. It gets her, you know, they laugh at her basically. Uh-huh. I mean, they just totally disparage her aspirations. So she sort of settles into the idea of, okay, I guess it's not going to be my lot in life, but she's never really satisfied with doing the regular things that the girls around her are doing. So she eventually became a leader in the abolitionist and women's rights movement. She moved away from Charleston. She moved up north and was basically disowned by her most of her family in order to do that. And her sister Angelina was also very involved in the movement. And you often hear, if you hear about Sarah, you hear about them together. The Grimke sisters is how they're referred to often. But in this particular book, Angelina plays a lesser role in the novel. It's really more focused on Sarah. And then it is in alternating chapters talks from the perspective of her slave, Handful, whose real name is Hetty, but she goes by Handful. And she also wants to be free. And she also wants something different from her life than to just be a slave. And so she finds different ways of being a little bit subversive. Mm-hmm. And Sarah, when they're both young girls, they're about the same age. And Sarah is given Hetty as a present, a birthday present. And Sarah tries to free her. She says, you know, if she's my slave, then I have the right to free her. Mm-hmm. And her parents basically say, no, you can't do that. And so Sarah teaches Handful how to read and write and does what she can to make it so that Handful doesn't have a typical slave's life. So as I said, it is in alternating chapters between each woman, which gives a great perspective on each of their lives and what they're each fighting for and how the slave perspective is more brutal than Sarah's perspective, but they're both living under oppression and they're both living in circumstances that they don't want to live in. And you get into their thought process of why they do what they do. And there's a very strong sense of place. We're near Charleston and I go to Charleston very frequently. So I loved the pictures in my head that she was able to create in her descriptions of Charleston in the pre-Civil War era. And it's also a very moving story because you go along the journey with these women. It encompasses probably 30 to 35 years of their lives. So you really grow up with them. When you first meet them, they're young girls. And by the time you're leaving their story, they're adults. And I thought it was a great book club pick. We read this in my book club a year or two ago, and it engendered a lot of great discussion about slavery and the women's rights movement and abolition. And it's just, there's a lot to learn there. And I, growing up, never knew of the Grimke sisters. Right. I don't know if that's something they teach more locally, but yeah. I never heard of these women. And they had a huge impact on both the abolition and women's rights movements. In fact, they were sort of told not to support women's rights because it was taking away focus from abolition, but they felt very strongly that they were tied together. And so they were headstrong and just separated themselves from the abolition movement to a little faction that could also support women's rights. So they did a lot at a time that women didn't have much of a voice.
Yeah. I sort of wonder how this book circulated outside of our area because our holds list was like a year before we started seeing copies just on the shelf because it deals so much with the low country. And it really is a shame that they're not better known, but I had the same experience before I moved here. I'd never heard of them.
I know we have a book in our library system that are the letters of the Grimke sisters or the journals of the Grimke sisters. And that would get circulated. And so that was the first time I had heard of them until this book. Now, I hope that it did bring some national attention to them because Sue Monk Kidd wrote The Secret Life of Bees.
Right.
Maybe what would that have been 10 years ago? Something and that was a very popular book club book across the country, not just in the South. So I hope that because her name was attached to this book, people would pick it up outside of just our area.
Right. And I know that there was the abolitionist or abolition, can't remember the name of it. I think it's abolitionist documentary on PBS and the Grimke sisters are covered in that. So
So maybe they're getting more known now than they were when we were growing up. But I definitely had never heard of them before I moved here.
Yeah, they're amazing. Yeah.
So that was The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd.
Good pick.
Thank you. And we're going to take a quick break and we will be right back. And what are you reading this week?
I'm reading The Alphabet House by U.C. Adler Olson. This is another World War II book, so it's my theme for the week. He is famous for writing the Department Q series, mm-hmm. which is a Scandinavian noir detective series. And this is actually the first book he ever wrote before that series, but it was just published. It was originally published in 1997 and released in Denmark, but then only released in the US either this year or last year, but very recently. Like I said, it's set in World War II, and it's about two British pilots that are shot down in Germany, and they both survive, and they're being chased by British troops. So in order to escape them, they jump aboard a train that's carrying wounded German soldiers, and they know that they'll be found on this train at some point. There's no way they can just hide themselves. So the only thing that they can think to do is to take the place of some of the wounded soldiers. And so they throw these two soldiers off the train and take their places in their beds. And they happen to be officers. And so they know that eventually it's going to be discovered. So their plan is they're going to get to some place and then escape later on and get off this train. But they don't realize that the officers don't have physical injuries, but they're actually mental injuries, and that the train is going to mental institution called Alphabet House, and the only way that they can survive is if they fake insanity. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It's so exciting. So once they get to the hospital, then the conditions there are just so terrible. The staff is constantly trying to catch the patients in lies. So they'll do things. They'll do these little tests to see if they're faking their condition, or they'll randomly throw things at them to see if they flinch or if they dodge it, because they know that would mean someone's faking it. And then of course they just kill them on the spot if they fail this test. So they know all of this is going on. Their reaction is to break their role, but they can't because they'll die. So I haven't gotten to this part, but the blurb says that they as they're continuing to live in the Alphabet House, they start to realize that they're not the only people that are pretending to be insane. So,
oh my gosh, yes, it sounds so good.
I know, it sounds so good. And UC Adler Olson is really good at the descriptions of the hospital. He puts good attention to detail in his books. So there's like a moment on the train when they realize that the officers are all tattooed with their ID numbers, and they're going to have to somehow tattoo themselves so that they're not immediately discovered. So they get dirt and a pin and just prick themselves and make it so that obviously that's not going to pass with a really thorough examination, but for their purposes, they can get by with that. There's a really bleak descriptions of this hospital, and it just has a really good sense of how terrifying this scenario is for them. At the place I am right now, it feels like it's a good read-alike for something like Shutter Island by Dennis Lehane. I don't know if that's just because it's the mental institution and sort of the thriller feel of it, but I'm excited. I'm only about 100 pages in, and so far it's really fascinating. So I would recommend that to everyone. It's called The Alphabet House by UC Adler Olson.
That sounds so good. I've read a couple, I think, in the series that he uh-huh. writes. Q is
Department Q. Q.
Department yeah. Q. But I didn't know that this wasn't part of the series.
That it just sort of showed up in, yes. I got it as a pre-release from a publisher and didn't finish it at that time, and I'm getting back to it. And I thought this is so exciting to have this random special book that yes. has not been released here. So it's fun.
Well, what I'm reading this week is Who Do You Love by Jennifer Weiner. And this is about Rachel Bloom and Andy Landis, who meet in a hospital emergency room when they're 8 years old. She is there because she has a congenital heart defect that ever since she was a baby, she's had multiple surgeries to try to fix. And so she spent about a month in this hospital, and for entertainment, she'll wander around the hospital and try to find a good story to tell a friend of hers that is also in the children's ward. And so she goes down to the emergency room, and Andy is there. He has a broken arm. He's there all by himself, and he has broken his arm because he was looking for his mom at a hotel and fell off a balcony. And the mother, he's been there for an hour, and his mom, they cannot find his mother. So they both are coming from lonely, isolated places because she spent so much time in hospitals growing up that she hasn't had much of a natural, normal childhood. And he's had a lot of isolation from, he doesn't have a father and his mother neglects him. And so she sits and tells him a story until his mother shows up and he can have his arm fixed or the cast put on. And then they meet up again years later when they're both in high school doing a community service project in
in Atlanta building a house, and they immediately connect again. They recognize each other, mm-hmm. and they're immediately connected. And the book is over the course of their lives, they keep being drawn back together, but then their differences and their different upbringings. Rachel comes from like an upper middle class Jewish family. Her parents were very protective because of her heart condition, and have given her a very, not luxurious life, but a comfortable life. Mm-hmm. And Andy's had to deal with a lot more with poverty and got in some trouble when he was younger. And he, like I said, doesn't have a father. And so they just have very different backgrounds. And so those differences can kind of drive them apart, but yet they keep being drawn back together. And it almost reminded me a little bit of One Day by David Nichols. Did you ever read that book?
I haven't read it, but I know of it. Yeah.
It's a similar, it's not the same structure, but in that book, he took a couple and on the same day each year would kind of check back in with where they were in their lives. And this is the same idea, except it's just at different times. So like at one point it's September 11th and one of them is in New York City. And so, you know, it's like times like that. It's a different portion. Parts of their lives, and it checks back in and where they are in their relationship to each other and where they just are in general in their lives. And I don't know if they're going to end up together. Like it's I hope they do, because it seems like it's, you know, a romance love story, but at the same time, I can sort of see her pulling the rug out from under you. And being like, well, maybe sometimes it's just not meant to be, even though they're drawn to each other. But she just really knows all the Jennifer Weiner books I've read. I feel like she writes such an engaging story. I can't put this book down. I keep staying up a little bit too late every night to try to read a few more pages. And it's a perfect book to pick up if you've had a busy week or you need a little bit of a distraction, because it's a story that just completely has pulled me in. And if you want something that you just can't wait to find out what happens next. So that's Who Do You Love by Jennifer Weiner. All right. Should we go over the list of what we talked about today?
Yeah, that sounds great. My books were Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, Life and Death in Shanghai by Nian Chang, Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine. And what I'm reading this week is The Alphabet House by UC Adler Olson.
And I talked about The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot, Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal by Connor Grennan, The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd, and what I'm reading this week is Who Do You Love by Jennifer Weiner. If you want to get in touch with us to give us feedback or a suggestion on a topic you'd like us to discuss, you can email us at wellreadpod@gmail.com or on Twitter at wellreadpodcast. Also, please let us know if you've read any of our suggestions. We'd love to hear that. Please rate and review us on iTunes or your other podcast provider of choice. Our podcast is engineered by Adam Farver. Our theme music is Kitten by Poddington Bear. We keep our show notes at beaufortcountylibrary.org/wellread, where you can find a listing of every book we talked about in this episode. If you'd like a book recommendation list tailored specifically for you, please go to beaufortcountylibrary.org/mynextbook, and you'll take a brief survey on what type of books you like, and we'll get back to you within 7 days with a list. You will need a Beaufort County Library card in order to use that service. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading.